Kevin Drinkwater in a talk entitled The Dead Sea Scrolls.
Mr. President and friends, a little time ago, I came across this extract from the second annual Congress of the European Section of the TS held in London in July 1905. It was a paper by Annie Besant on the conditions of occult research. And it sums up so wonderfully well the attitude to occult research, which we of the Theosophical Research Center endeavor to follow, that I would like to read it to you. What then is the value of occult research if you cannot prove it? I think this, that it may give hints which may possibly, if scientific men would take them as working hypotheses, facilitate and quicken discoveries that might otherwise be long delayed. I do not claim anything more than that. I do not think any scientific man ought to accept our visions and think them true. But I think he might utilize them if he sees anything in them to give a hint of possible discovery. The investigator should say, I give you my best, but your best attitude towards it is that of careful analysis and rigorous scrutiny. That is a service I think the occult researcher has a right to expect at your hands. And another thing to remember is that we are not omniscient. Our observations are often very imperfect. We see a little bit of a thing and give it out as a whole, or we see it out of relation and that gives the wrong impression. I think then that an observation made only by one person, they ought to be issued as seen by only one person, leaving them open for later confirmation if that should come. If that is done, occult research will play a great and useful part in our movement. If it is not done, it is more a danger than a help. A double danger, for the seer may be misled by not having other observations to correct his own. And a danger that the readers may be misled by taking as some infallible revelation the single observation of a fallible man. It is under these conditions that I desire that occult research should go forward, a willingness to correct whatever wider knowledge shows error to have been made, a willingness to repeat and verify and accept no observations without investigation and careful thought. I think we may say that since those statements, that policy has been pretty consistently followed by the Theosophical Society. As far as I know, occult investigators have always made it clear whether their statements are made simply on their own observations or in association with others. But in relation to this particular subject of tonight, that of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that I would suggest is a very well-suited subject for occult research. A great deal of occult research has to do with layers of consciousness and with vast sweeps of time which are quite outside the possible range of scientific verification at the present time. It may someday be that they will be within the range of scientific verification. We have heard of the Akashic Records, and we see a sort of physical plane representation of the Akashic Records in the tape recorder, which is working behind this screen now. It takes down what I am saying or anybody else is saying. The BBC have got a recorder which takes down vision as well as sound. And it takes it down in such a way that no scientific analysis whatever, no chemical analysis, no physical examination by a microscope or anything of that kind will detect the slightest difference in the tape. It's simply absolutely the same as it was before to all ordinary means of investigation. It's not until you put it through a particular instrument that you get forth your record. And so we have seen demonstrated in recent years, before our very eyes and ears, we have seen a scientific photometry, a recording of the past. And it does not seem so incredible after all when we realize that computers and electron apparatus of that sort can store millions of facts, literally millions, in a few disks or tapes. So that it does not seem, judging from that, that someday we may have instruments which will record what every object has perceived in front of it, so to speak. Such as a psychometer, a sort of mechanical psychometry. It does not seem impossible. And in fact, it is prophesied in Man Whence, How and Whither, there will be such machines 1,200 years from now or so. And therefore, in that range of time, or perhaps considerably less, a great many things which are now outside the range of scientific verification will be verified and will become accepted facts. But as regards coming down to our present day period, in our present day possibilities, the Dead Sea Scrolls form, and its cognate subject, the birth of Jesus 100 years earlier than the received date, is an ideal form for study in relation to occult research, because the idea that Christ lived and held his ministry 100 years before the accepted day is so entirely contrary to the received view, is it not? We all know that. And also the received view is so very well attested, or seemingly so very well attested. The New Testament is the best attested book of any ancient work. Far more manuscripts exist, far more time has been put on it by critical scholars, some of them Christians, some of them non-Christians, than any other work that has come down to us from antiquity. And so we have got something to face, so to speak, when we claim that that record is 100 years out. We have certainly got something to face. On the other hand, there has been a tradition, rather thin, but there has been a tradition here and there, handed down, in spite of great difficulties, of the earlier date. And this tradition is not very well marked, it is not very strong, because in the days of Domitian, assuming that the 100 BC date is correct for the moment, in the days of Domitian, Christian works were burnt wholesale, and in the days of Constantine, the Christians returned the compliment by burning all heretical works wholesale, and successive emperors did the same, and in the Middle Ages, of course, the Inquisition went on that sort of thing on a grand scale. So that if there was any sort of record different from the accepted one, it would have a considerable difficulty in surviving at all, quite apart from the long time that has elapsed. Considerable difficulty. Nevertheless, there is such a tradition. It has survived to some extent, and some attention has been paid to it. Now, in that extract which I just read to you, Mrs. Besant makes the point that we should make it clear whether occult research is based on a particular point, is based on one person or on several. Well, in this particular subject, that of the date of Christ as 100 years earlier, approximately 100 years earlier than the received date, there has been very distinguished occult support indeed. It does not rest on one person's observations. The first statement made to that effect is in 1883 by Mahatma K.H., when he was commenting on a paper being published in The Theosophist by Eliphas Levi, or at least a translation of a paper by Eliphas Levi. And in the course of that paper, Levi says that Jesus, like all great hierophants, had a secret teaching. And the comment at the footnote was, by the master, was, yes, but he lived 100 years before his birth. Then H.P.B. briefly referred to it that same year in The Theosophist, and in 1901, Mrs. Besant gave out further information, Esoteric Christianity, in which she definitely dated. She said it was based on what H.P.B. said and other occultists. And she said that Jesus, the disciple Jesus, was born 105 B.C., and she names two consuls, Roman consuls, who were presiding over the fortunes of Rome at the time. I've looked up those consuls, and they did, it is part of Orthodox history, it's not an occult corroboration, of course, but it is a historical fact that those two particular consuls, they only reigned for a year or two, did preside over the fortunes of Rome 105 B.C. And then she goes on to say that he was trained in the Essene communities of Judea, and eventually at the age of 16, at age of 19, went to Egypt, was initiated into the Egyptian mysteries, and when he was age 29, came back to Judea and began the ministry. And then when we go a little bit further, and then all too soon, as she puts it, the opposition resulted in the great tragedy, his rejection and violent death. It doesn't give any details of that, but C.W. Leadbeater in the inner side of things and the hidden side of Christian festivals gives us a further point that that Jesus was stoned to death, and he also makes a very important statement that there was an individual called Jesus, an obscure revolutionary who did live at the time of Pilate, and that this individual was confused in the gospel story with that of the true master. So that is a point which we ought to remember, that there were two individuals. But as there were two individuals, it is not open to us to say, oh, well, the Dead Sea Scrolls show that such and such an individual did live 100 years, and therefore it's proved. Nothing of the sort, because one could say, oh, yes, but the other side could say, if we're going to take sides on this thing, and it's probably unscientific to do so, the other side could say, well, certain traditions, perhaps, in the Dead Sea Scrolls have been confused with the real Christian master who did live in the days of Pontius Pilate. And the crux is very strong and severe, so to speak, the historical crux on this matter, because the Romans weren't in Judea at the alleged time of the ministry, according to the occult data. They didn't come into Judea. They didn't conquer Judea till 63 BC. The ministry was over by then, if the occult data is correct. So everything that gives us a Roman setting to the ministry is not historical. It's not historical if the occult data is true. So you can see one has a very considerable problem, a very fascinating problem. If the occult data is true, how can you explain all these other things? So it is not sufficient, as I say, to simply look to the scrolls, no matter what scrolls may be, what further discoveries may be made, or how remarkable they may be made. I think we must still deal with the New Testament evidence. Otherwise, we would simply be quite logical and to say, yes, one person has been confused with the other, but the real founder of the Christian religion lived in the days of Pontius Pilate. If we take St. Paul's evidence, he mentions crucifixion very often, the cross and the crucifixion. He doesn't give details of the crucifixion. He does say in Thessalonians that Christ was slain and hanged on a tree. But he does elsewhere, he uses the term crucifixion. Now, the Greek word for the cross, staros, does not necessarily mean the Roman form of crucifixion. It has a wider meaning than is conveyed in the English word cross and its derivative, crucifixion. According to the Romans, the cross might take a simple stake. Staros simply means stake. Or it could be a tower-shaped object, or it could be a Latin cross. A person could be simply bound to the stake and not nailed at all and left to die of thirst and exposure, or he might be nailed. It isn't clear. Simply, the use of the word crucifixion doesn't necessarily imply nailing or anything more than that. But in the Roman form of the punishment, the individual was alive when fastened to the cross, in the Roman form of judicial impalement or crucifixion. Now, the Jews, on the other hand, had a stoning. They executed by stoning, in most cases, sometimes a beheading, usually by stoning, and then the dead body was placed on the upright stake or tree. Because in the late Jewish period, they no longer hung the body of a convicted criminal on a tree, an actual tree growing outside, so to speak, but it had become simply a stake with a piece sticking out of the top, and the hands of the victim were bound together, and it was hung up on that object like that. They were stoned to death and then hung on a tree, hung on a stake. Well, you can see the similarity between that and the Roman form. If you simply talk about crucifixion, it's very close. And it can be shown that in Jewish circles, sometimes the word crucifixion was used for the hanging up of a dead body. It can be used. So the word crucifixion does not necessarily mean the hanging up of a live one. Therefore, when St. Paul, who is our earliest witness, remember, writing quite a long time before the Gospels, he is our earliest witness, earliest Christian witness to the ministry, St. Paul, when he speaks of the cross and crucifixion, is not necessarily talking about a Roman crucifixion at all. Now, Mrs. Besant makes it clear that St. Paul did live about the time that tradition says that he lived. That is, he lived about 100 times after the occult date. He never knew the master in the flesh, and he never knew anyone who had met the master in the flesh. He lived 100 years afterwards. It was too far back. He nowhere says that he knew an actual eyewitness of the ministry. Not when you carefully analyze what he has to say. He does talk about apostles, but the word apostles, as used by him, means more than the 12. He calls himself an apostle. He was not one of the 12. He refers to several other people as apostles. Apostles means literally one sent. It doesn't mean anything more than missionary. Therefore, when St. Paul talks about apostles in his genuine writings, you need not assume that he is talking about eyewitness to the ministry. But in Galatians, after he has seen the risen Christ, he'd persecuted the church, remember, then he had this sudden vision on the road to Damascus of the risen Christ. Saul, Saul, why dost thou persecute me? He goes to Jerusalem, and there he meets James, Cephas, and John, who seem to be pillars, and they gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship. Merely seem to be pillars. Not were pillars. Surely if they were the original 12, wouldn't, who knew the Lord in the flesh and journeyed all over the country with him, they would have been pillars. No, merely seem to be pillars. And he puts James first, not Peter. Well, you know, there has been discussion for centuries as to how many Jameses there are in the New Testament. If you read Luke, Acts, which belong together, only two. If you read Galatians and other sources and various early writers, there are three. And this third James is the one whom St. Paul apparently says is an eyewitness to the ministry, because he says, he speaks of James, the Lord's brother. And that seems to refer to somebody who knew the Lord in the flesh. So Paul knew James, the Lord's brother. But in the Greek, it's Adelphus, brother. It can mean a blood brother in classical Greek, but it can also mean, and particularly in biblical Greek, it can mean merely relative. So, strictly speaking, we're not justified in calling James the Lord's brother anything else than James the Lord's relative. So St. Paul never once says clearly and unambiguously that he knew an eyewitness. Therefore, we're not obliged to alter anything in St. Paul's genuine epistles. The pastoral epistles are generally agreed as being overworked in the second century. There is a reference to Pontius Pilate in one of those. We can put that to one side. We're not obliged to make any changes in the generally accepted view by the vast majority of scholars today. They accept the substantial genuineness of St. Paul's epistles. We're not obliged to say they've been heavily interpolated or anything of that kind. We can take them just as they are, and I think that is a considerable advantage. Well, what about the Gospels? Well, in Mark's Gospel, which is the earliest, Christ visits the village of Bethsaida and heals a blind man. It was no longer a village at the time of Pontius Pilate. It had been rebuilt and was a city, and it had been renamed by the Tetrarch Philip round about 6 AD, had been renamed Bethsaida Julius. The distinction between a city and village is clearly made in the Greek text of the New Testament. A city is a building, polis, one which has a wall around it. A village has not got a wall. Bethsaida Julius was rebuilt, it had its wall, and was no longer the village of Bethsaida at the time of Pontius Pilate. That Jesus enters the village of Bethsaida. And when you go into Luke's Gospel, there's a portion of Luke's Gospel, not derived from Mark, but from some other source, where also in the genuine text it refers to the village of Bethsaida. So that is just a hint that embedded in the Gospels we may well have written sources behind the Gospels which go back to this earlier period. We will have great difficulties, I think, in persuading any scholar, even I'm not talking about Christian scholars, but people who have no particular axe to grind. We have great difficulty persuading that the Gospels have been heavily interpolated. I think it would be much stronger ground if we say, take them as they are, that they were written towards the end of the first century, or perhaps earlier in the second, and but they have behind them earlier sources. They have sources which may go back to this 100 BC period. Now, in the fourth gospel, we have a reference to Nicodemus. That was a rare Jewish name. There's only two Nicodemuses being traced in Jewish tradition, in early Jewish tradition. One was at the time of the destruction of the temple, which is too late, and the other was 100 years earlier than the received date. He was an official belonging to the court of Salome Alexandra, the queen of the Jews, before the Romans came into Judea. So there's just a hint there. And there's also the statement when they speak about the destruction of the temple, and Christ says, I'll rebuild this temple in 3 days. The Jew says, 46 years was this temple in building. That does not work out at all well for Herod's temple, but it can work out for the second temple, that is Zerubbabel. If Jesus entered the temple 100 years earlier than we think, it was the second temple he entered. Herod hadn't yet come onto the scene. There were no Herods in those days. So there are little indications like that which suggest there is possibly an earlier tradition embedded in the Gospels. But you will see, perhaps very startlingly, not particularly strong. Interesting, significant, suggestive, but we couldn't call it proof. Now, if we take Luke, Acts, which we must take together because they both come from the same hand, tradition says they are, and the style has been analyzed very closely by Greek experts, and Luke, Acts, as we have it, has come from the same hand, or if we say, if you like, the same editor, you'll find in the first part of Acts, which tells you what happened afterwards, so to speak, what happened after the crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of the Lord, what did the disciples do after that, how did the church start, you'll find in the first few chapters of Acts mention of the 12 apostles, no mention of St. Paul, and Peter is at the head of the church. But in the later chapters, when St. Paul comes on the scene, it is no longer Peter who decides, it's James who decides. And it would take too long to go into detail here, but there is reasonable evidence to show that there has been two separate sources put together to make up the book of Acts as we know it. The first source goes back 100 years earlier, when the 12 were still in existence, or at least there were 12 disciples, or a group of disciples who had known the Lord, and the latter part of Acts, which has to do with St. Paul's time. And in St. Paul's time, it is not Peter who is the head of affairs, it's James. Whether James, Peter, and John, whom Paul knew, I suggest, are duplicates. James was a common name, John was a common name. We don't know how many Jameses there were. The arguments have gone on for centuries, as I remarked, as to how many James there were. The argument has similarly gone on about John and Peter. There's some evidence that even Peter was a common name, and one or two of the fathers say there were two Peters. So you see, it isn't too incredible to suggest that there's been an overlapping of names, and even the name Jesus was common in those days. In fact, in the genuine text of Matthew, Barabbas was Jesus Barabbas, the genuine text. Jesus Barabbas. Barabbas means son of the Father. Have we not there got a relic of the second Jesus, which occult investigation suggests existed? A second individual called Jesus. Jesus Barabbas. And could there not be some confusion with such a similarity of name? So then in Luke Acts, as I've said, there is this possibility of earlier sources, and in the fourth gospel and in Mark, and St. Paul, when properly translated and interpreted, doesn't really give any grounds for the traditional view. And let me say here, in passing, that the heading in our modern Bibles, the Gospel according to St. Matthew, the Gospel according to St. Mark, etc., was added by later copyists. Everybody recognizes that. The writer of Matthew's Gospel, whoever he may be, never claimed to be an eyewitness. He didn't say, I'm Matthew writing this Gospel. He didn't put that heading at the top of his Gospel, the Gospel according to St. Matthew. That was much later. And the same way Mark, John Mark, the companion of Peter, the Peter who knew Paul, never said, I am writing this Gospel. He doesn't claim to be an eyewitness. And Luke Acts, the writer of Luke Acts, whoever he may be, doesn't definitely claim to be Luke, the companion of Paul. All claim to be an eyewitness. So they're honest documents. They're not bogus documents. If the date is wrong, they're not written by people attempting to, they're written honestly, they're not attempting, written by people claiming to be eyewitnesses or nothing of the sort. They're honest documents. In the fourth gospel, you do get the claim of an eyewitness at the very end, and there's a very peculiar construction in the Greek, and it's been suggested it's been a later addition. The very end, the very last two verses of the fourth gospel. So, naturally, putting it rather briefly, we can suggest that there is a certain amount of evidence in the Gospels and in the New Testament for which permits of one accepting this older idea, this older date. I might just mention in passing that we can take the three epistles, epistle according to James, the epistle according to John, the book of Revelation, and the one Peter, epistle of Peter. There is no reason whatever to doubt that the Peter whom St. Paul knew, and who never knew Christ in the flesh, who was 100 years later, you see, that Peter wrote 1 Peter. He doesn't claim to be an eyewitness, properly translated. There's no reason to doubt that the book of Revelation could be written by the John whom St. Paul knew, and he doesn't claim to be an eyewitness. He speaks of the 12 apostles as though he was somebody else, as though he's not one of their number. He doesn't claim to be an eyewitness. And there is no reason why the epistle of James couldn't have been written by the James whom Paul knew. He doesn't claim to be an eyewitness, and he certainly doesn't write as though he was a blood brother of Christ. In fact, he only mentions Christ once. He calls him the Just One, the righteous one, which is a title applied to the teacher of righteousness in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Very well, then, if there was an alternative tradition, a different one than the received one, and we can say St. Luke in his preamble, I'm calling him traditionally St. Luke, in his preamble, says, many have taken into hand to write about these things. Where are these many? You see, there were many accounts. They haven't come down to us. Where are they now? If there was a different tradition, could we not expect some alternative evidence, some idea of it to have survived? If it is true, apart from the Dead Sea Scrolls, which we'll come to in a minute. Well, there is. Now, G.R.S. Meade wrote a book, as no doubt everyone is aware, in 1909, Did Jesus Live 100 B.C.? And he analyzes various Jewish traditions, mostly from the Talmud and from a Jewish work called the Toldeth Yeshu. Now, the Talmud says nothing about Pontius Pilate, nothing whatever. Nothing whatever about the Romans as being responsible for the death of Christ. And the Jews had every inducement, so to speak, to put the blame onto the Romans if they could, because they were blamed for the death of Christ. Could they not have said, oh, it wasn't my fault, it was Pontius Pilate's fault? They never say that. There isn't a word about Pontius Pilate in the whole of the Talmud. There isn't a word about the Romans having anything whatever to do with the death of Jesus. Instead, Jesus flees to Alexandria of Egypt round about 88 B.C. with a distinguished Jewish rabbi because of the cruel actions of the Jewish king Jannaeus, which I'll come to in a moment. So there's that one text which completely contradicts the received view but supports the occult investigations. But we must be fair here, the Talmud did not begin to be put into writing until the 3rd and 4th century of our era, a long time after the Gospels. But everybody agrees the Talmud is based on an ancient oral tradition. Nobody doubts that they have genuine traditions in the Talmud of rabbis going back several centuries, but it was not written down. And the Talmud is full of contradictions and historical inconsistencies. So it is not according to scientific criticism to base that one statement, if it stood alone, as against the great weight of evidence of the Gospels. There is another work, the Toldeth Yeshu, usually dated as medieval, which places Jesus at the time we specify, 100 years earlier, the time one suggests. But that is medieval, it's very late. But there have been two Jewish scholars, Krauss and Schoenfield, the latter has sometimes lectured at the TS, I believe, in London, who have suggested that it could be as early as the 5th century, and that is a parody of a lost gospel. Parody of a lost gospel. So that is just a hint that there was a lost gospel which places Jesus at this earlier date. Now, before we go on to the scrolls, we must just briefly outline the historical background in Judea at this period of which we're discussing. The Seleucid kings, the Syrian kings, non-Jews, had attempted to conquer the Jews by force and make them worship their gods, which of course was complete anathema from the Jewish point of view. The one great central rallying call of the Jewish spirit down through the centuries is there is the one God and we worship him and none other, not a multiple of gods. And Judas Maccabeus, in the middle of the 2nd century, rallied the people and with him his sons, and they fought off the Seleucids and achieved independence of Judea. His successors, the Maccabean family, eventually took on the title of king until we find about 103 B.C., King Jannaeus, one of the Maccabeans, ascended the throne. So at the time Christ was born, Herod the Great was not the king of Judea, that was 100 years later, but Jannaeus. Now, in St. Matthew's Gospel, we have that very terrible story of the slaughtering of the innocents. We have the very beautiful story of the star which appears in the east, and the wise men go and say, we have come to worship him who lies in the manger. And later, the Christ child with his mother and Joseph arise at the warning of an angel and journey to Egypt. And Herod kills all the children 2 years and under. Now, you know, there's absolutely no historical evidence whatever that any such monstrous act ever was done by Herod. He was a pretty tough customer, if I might put it that way. And Josephus records a great many of his crimes. He was no hero to Josephus. Josephus wrote about the end of the first century AD. His father was a priest in the temple at the time of Pontius Pilate. He knew Jewish traditions very well. The Jewish mind has always been very attentive to its wrongs and anything has happened to it, like other peoples we can name. Surely they would have remembered this terrible thing of Herod, who was only half a Jew and was greatly detested by the Jews, if he had killed their young children in this wholesale manner. Josephus hasn't got a word about it. The Talmud hasn't got a word about it. I think the evidence, though it's dangerous to argue from silence, always dangerous to argue from silence, the likelihood of that being omitted is so minute that we can say the thing can hardly have happened in the way it's described. But Jannaeus slew children. He had a battle with fell out with the Pharisees. And he crucified, he defeated them at Bethany, which sounds very like Bethany. He defeated them at Bethany, crucified, according to the Talmud, he crucified about 800 of them. And while the men were dying, he butchered their wives and children before them. And it was then, as a result of that terrible act, that monstrous act, that Jesus, a young man, not a child, went to Egypt. That is a historical fact. Josephus mentions it, the Talmud mentions it. The other, there is no mention. And what is more, Halley's Comet appeared in the year 87. That is in ancient Chinese records, 87 BC. It is in ancient Chinese records, and it is also according to modern astronomical calculations. And it appeared, for those of you astrologers, it appeared in the sign of Virgo. It appeared in August, in the sign of Leo, which is the ancient sign of kingship. So it might well have been taken as a portent of a king. However that may be, Jesus flees to Egypt at about the time that the Halley's Comet appeared in Judea. And there is no known comet or astronomical phenomena which we can link up with the orthodox date. So I think that kind of congruity does give one a little bit of substance to this idea, though it would be unjustifiable, of course, to claim it to be proof. Then, in the Sibylline oracles, there are two very cryptic verses which have a bearing on this subject. In antiquity, as no doubt you're all aware, there was the custom of the Sibyls uttering oracular pronouncements about the future of those who went to consult them. And there were various Jewish and Christian writers who took that as a form of a literary form and uttered their own Sibylline prophecies. And of course, prophesying has been going on ever since. Now, some of these oracles have come down to us. And there are two of them which are of particular interest. The first is dated the 1st or 2nd century BC, and runs as follows. When Rome shall o'er Egypt also rule, governing always, then there shall appear the greatest kingdom of the immortal king over men. And a holy Lord shall come to hold the scepter over every land unto all ages of fast hastening time. And then shall come inexorable wrath on Latin men. Three shall by piteous fate endamage Rome, and perish shall all men with their own houses, when from heaven shall flow a fiery cataract. Now, it is only the early Christian church, and it is only the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it is not found in the Jewish writings, any prophecy of the immediate end of the world through a fiery cataract. That's the first point. How the Christian church got to an idea, I don't know, but it evidently did. That's the first point. The second point is, three men shall by piteous fate endamage Rome. Well, if you remember your history books, in the first century B.C., Rome was governed by a triumvirate. There were two triumvirates. We needn't worry about the second. It doesn't apply at all. But the first is a different matter. The first triumvirate consisted of Crassus, Caesar, and Pompey. And those three did endamage Rome. Crassus endamaged Rome considerably by attacking the Parthians, who proved to be very much stronger than he realized, and the Romans were troubled by attacks from the Parthians for a long time. After Crassus' death, Pompey became jealous of Caesar, and a civil war broke out, and Pompey met a violent end. And as we know, of course, Julius Caesar was assassinated. There are no three men, one's gone carefully through the history, there are no three men which fit except these three. So that we must date this prophecy as sometime early than 60 BC when the triumvirate was formed. And we can't date it very much later than the time of Julius Caesar because fire didn't come forth and destroy the world and Rome and all the rest of it. You see the argument? There must have been, this prophecy must date therefore to sometime in the first century BC. The Holy Lord shall come to hold the scepter over every land unto all ages of fast hastening time, and then shall come inexorable wrath. After this, Lord, on the Latin men, three shall by piteous fate endamage Rome. And so I think entirely consistent without any straining, we can say this prophesies a messianic king, and after him there came these three men, who the first triumvirate. Therefore there was a messianic king, according to this prophecy, before the formation of the triumvirate in 60 BC. Well, the next one is even clearer. And when the Persian land shall be quit of war, this is written before AD 30 and could have been even earlier, according to some experts. And when the Persian land shall be quit of war and of pestilence and lamentation, then there shall be on that day the godlike heavenly race of the blessed Jews, who dwell around the city of God at the center of the earth. Jerusalem is called the center of the earth in Isaiah. Building a great ring wall as far as Joppa, they shall be exalted to the darkening clouds. No more shall the trumpet hiss forth the blast of war's turmoil, nor shall they perish any more by the fanatic hand of their foes. Then there shall come forth from the sky a certain exalted man, whose hands they nailed or spread upon a fruitful tree, the noblest of the Hebrews, who calls the sun to stand still. Now that is a very remarkable prophecy. Let us take it in stages. Let us take the last bit first. The noblest of the Hebrews who calls the sun to stand still. Well, who calls the sun to stand still? Joshua. But Joshua is Jesus in Hebrew. So the name is given. Jesus calls the sun to stand still. Someone called Jesus will come forth from the sky, a certain exalted man whose name is Jesus. And he had caused the sun to stand still. And this man, his hands are nailed or spread upon the fruitful tree. It's simply absolutely certain and definite that it does refer to Christ. But what about the ring wall as far as Joppa? Well, a wall was built, and there's only one in the history books. A wall was built from Joppa by Alexander Danaus about 86 BC to try and keep out the Seleucids. So then we get the series of events that there is the wall as far as Joppa, then no more shall the trumpet hiss forth. For 9 years after Danaus' death, which occurred not very long after the wall was built, there was peace. For 9 years there was peace. After that it was very far from peaceful. The Romans came in and there was endless insurrections. And it was during that 9 years that the ministry took place according to the occult investigation. So you see, here we have an oracle which cannot be fitted into any other period, which puts Christ quite plainly in that period and fits in exactly with the results of occult research. And as far as I can see, no one has ever been able to suggest that it be fitted in any other direction, any other period. When Janus died, having did these terrible things to the Pharisees, when he was on his deathbed, he persuaded his widow, his queen, Salome, to make friends with the Pharisees. He said, make friends with them, you won't be strong enough to rule by yourself, She did so, and for 9 years she ruled Judea. And it was during that time, which if the occult investigations are correct, that Jesus' ministry took place. Because, you see, Mrs. Besant says he was born 105 B.C. When he was 29, he came back. He came back from Egypt and then began the ministry, and it only lasted 3 years. And that brings us into the reign, just into the reign of Alexander Salome. And it agrees with what the Talmud says about Jesus going to Egypt and then coming back. She also says that he went to Egypt when he was 19. Well, that brings you to the year 86. And the Halley's Comet appeared in 87. You see, everything fits in, interlocks very well indeed. We have the star appearing in the sky, and Jesus goes to both according to the occult records and according to the Talmud. They're both linked together by an unseen circumstance, Halley's Comet, which appeared just about or just before that time. Well, that, so far as one has time to deal with, gives a sort of evidence as it stood up to the time of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, is a very difficult and very debated subject. I don't think it's quite fair to say that it is debated entirely because of the prejudices of the various scholars. That does come in sometimes. And some of the scholars have made claims which are very close to ours, or at least support our view, if we can call it our view for the moment, and later evidence and criticism has needed them to be restated or withdrawn to some extent. They may be true, but are not necessarily true. It's not the only view. To give you one example, there is a Penguin special by Allegro about the Dead Sea Scrolls, in which he says that the teacher of righteousness, who is unnamed in the Dead Sea Scrolls, nobody gives him a proper name, that he was crucified. Well, that's completely unjustifiable. Nowhere in the scrolls is any such statement being made. And we can safely say that it hasn't been made in any unpublished fragment of the scrolls so far, because a number of scholars challenged Allegro on this point, and he was unable to meet it. They said, we don't know of any evidence that any such thing happened. What is said is there's a fragment speaking of the lion who hanged up men alive. Now, that might quite well refer to Jannaeus hanging up the Pharisees alive. That might quite well do so, but it does not justify one in saying that the teacher of righteousness was hanged up alive. That is a Jewish, normal Jewish expression for crucifixion, hanging up men alive. That is one thing. Then there is another fragment which just gives the name of Salome Alexander. How very tantalizing. It doesn't make the teacher of righteousness of the same period as Alexander Salome, because this sect or group, whoever they may be, who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, or concerned with the Dead Sea Scrolls, have clearly lived for a considerable period of time, not for one brief period. There has been a great deal of controversy about it, but I think we can say now that no one will agree that they survived past the destruction of the temple in 68 to 70 AD, the settlement on the shores of the Dead Sea was destroyed at that time by the Romans. And some would say that the teacher of righteousness and the other individual and the wicked priest who was concerned with him, again unnamed, who was mentioned in the scrolls, could be as far back as 150 to 200 BC. But the general weight of opinion is now, one can see, gradually narrowing down, and as far as one can tell, that the majority opinion would place him sometime in the first century BC. So there was a teacher of righteousness who evidently had a very great effect on the sect of the Dead Sea, who lived in all probability, according to the present weight of opinion, during the first century before the Christian era, as normally dated. And this teacher is called, very most frequently, the teacher of righteousness, Mori HaZedek. And we're dealing here, remember, with Hebrew documents, whereas the New Testament is entirely in Greek. Now, in our authorized version, we miss this point, but Jesus is very often called teacher. It's generally translated master in the authorized version because a schoolmaster and a school teacher are interchangeable. But a better, more modern translation, about 90 times he is called teacher. Rather than, that's a more accurate, in terms of modern English, as distinguished from Elizabethan English, the more accurate to call him teacher. And in fact, that is done so in the New American Revised, the New Revised Version. And he's called the righteous one in the Acts, and he's also called the righteous one in the Epistle of James. So there is a similarity. Now, there is a mention in the Dead Sea Scrolls of the prophet, the prophet. It's not quite watertight that the teacher is the prophet. And who is the prophet? The prophet was prophesied by Moses. He said, "There will come a great prophet after me." And you remember in the opening of the fourth gospel, the Jews go to John the Baptist and say, "Art thou the Christ? Art thou the prophet?" And he said, "No," you see. They mean by that, are you the Messiah or are you the prophet prophesied of old? And in an early Christian heretical sect, the Ebionites, very often call Jesus the prophet. And he is called the prophet several times in the New Testament. Not stressed very strongly, but it is there. He is certainly given the title of the prophet. So he's given the title of the teacher, he's given the title of the prophet, he is given the title of the righteous or just one, like the teacher of righteousness in the scrolls. If we can be sure, which we cannot quite be sure, that the teacher of righteousness was in fact identified with the prophet forecast by Moses by the Dead Sea sect. It's very probable that he did. We can't say we know that the early sect took this step. The material is so fragmentary. Did they call him the Messiah? That, again, is a matter of argument. We don't know, on our present evidence, whether they did or did not call him the Messiah. Some say there were two Messiahs. One, a Messiah of Judah, the other, the Messiah of Levi. You see, the point about two Messiahs is this, that according to one Jewish tradition, the coming king would be of the Davidic line. Now, the succession, of course, is through the male line in Jewish thought and tradition. You cannot be of the line of Judah, the Davidic line, and simultaneously on the Levitical line. That was another tribe. You can't be descended on the paternal side. You see, from both. It's not possible, not strictly. But if you read the Levitical line was the priesthood, you see, and the Davidic line from Judah was the kingly line. If you read the ninth chapter of the Epistle of the Hebrews, you will find how they solve that one. The Christian church makes it, the author of the Epistle of the Hebrews says that Christ is of the order of Melchizedek. If you follow his argument, he says that Christ, though of the line of Judah, does inherit the Levitical line. He is the high priest as well as the king. So you could get, it might quite well be, that these two messianic claims were also combined in one individual in the Dead Sea Scrolls. We cannot say that they had actually done that, but it looks here and there as though they may have done so. And we cannot say that the Messiah, or the two Messiahs, which they were mentioned, was necessarily identified with the teacher of righteousness, though it looks here and there as though they did do so. So some scholars, the resemblance to Christ becomes so close, of course, that the tendency, I think, is to say they are separate individuals. For the Messiah and the teacher of righteousness were separate individuals. But they may well have been the same. We must wait for more. There's at least 10,000 more fragments waiting to be published. Any day now, we may get some more material. But there are a number of other fascinating points about the scrolls, even though it is a little disappointing that the verdict cannot be too positive on the very points in which we who are interested in these things would most like to have further light. There are three orders very well and closely marked in this Dead Sea sect. The Mabaka or overseers, the priests and the Levites, and the resemblance to bishops, priests and deacons is very close indeed, to take a lecture to go to in detail. But it is a fact. In fact, it's more clearly marked than it is in the New Testament. Bishops, priests, and deacons are not sufficiently clearly defined in the New Testament records. They're mentioned, but that's one of the arguments, of course, between Protestants and Catholics. But they are very clearly marked in the Dead Sea Scroll. There were these three orders, and the Rebbeka had the work of being overseers, so to speak. Equivalent, quite a number of writers have pointed out how they're equivalent to the Greek episcopus or overseer. Also, they had a rite of baptism. Also, they had a secret feast of bread and wine. And in the description of that feast, it says first the priest must bless it, and then the Messiah blesses it. And there must be 10 men present. At least 10. Is this a pre-Christian Essene banquet? We know from Josephus that the Essenes had a secret repast. Or is it a proto-Eucharistic action? I don't think we're justified in saying one way or the other at the present time, but it is very suggestive. Did they mean, they laid down this as a rule, this is a peculiarity of this thing, you see, that the priest and the Messiah must be present with the 10 men. But they had far more than 10 men. The Messiah couldn't have been present at all meetings of 10 men. Did they mean the Messiah would bless the bread and wine because he was spiritually present? It could mean that. I don't say it must mean that, but it could mean that. But the priest blesses the bread, then the Messiah, and then they partake of this banquet of bread and wine. And they have this baptismal rite, very clear, but of course there were other groups that had baptismal rites also amongst the Jews. So we cannot claim that quite to be specifically Christian. But we do find many contacts between the outlook and phraseology of the scrolls and that of the early church. And it is so marked that quite a number of scholars, in fact the majority, acknowledge the question to what extent and to what degree this contact has taken place. It's quite common, so to speak, though everything is so controversial, that it seems more or less agreed that St. Paul must have known either the actual documents we've found or very similar ones. What we've found is only a fragment of what once existed. We know that because the whole the caves were rifled many centuries ago. We've only found a small fragment. And interestingly enough and significantly enough, there are phrases which you find in the fourth gospel, such as the spirit of truth, a very Johannine phrase. That occurs in the scrolls. On the other hand, you do not find the strongly Christocentric theology, if I might put it that way, that you find in St. Paul. You do not find over and over again the mystic union with the teacher of righteousness, a salvation, however one may define that word, from the teacher of righteousness, which you find in St. Paul's Christology. Well, we must allow for St. Paul's being a later writer. We must allow for development of theology. And we must also realize that you don't find those things in the Epistle of James, for instance. You don't find it in the Philemon. You don't find it in the second and third epistles of John, though, to be fair, they're very short indeed. What we have actually found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, which refers to the teacher of righteousness, is very short, really. There have been various books of the Old Testament and other work rites, such as the text of Isaiah. The actual material which refers to the teacher and which refers to the unknown wicked priest who persecuted him is quite short, tantalizingly short. That's why it's so controversial, why it's so uncertain. But nowhere else do we find anybody but the Church and the Dead Sea Scroll sect, whoever they may be, calling themselves a New Covenant. A New Testament, a New Covenant. There's no other Jewish sect claimed that, but the early Church did, and this sect did. And that is a most tremendous claim, a New Covenant, from a Jewish point of view, remember. Jeremiah prophesies that in the distant days, God will write his law upon the heart, and he'll remember no more their sins. That was the claim made by the Dead Sea sect and by the early church. Both had a ministry. Both had a baptismal rite. Both had a Eucharistic rite or a bread and, shall we say, a bread and wine supper. Both make references to the Messiah. In the case of the Dead Sea Scroll, there's one reference which rather suggests that the Messiah had gone, or come and gone, but we can't quite prove that. Both refer to a teacher of righteousness, but the scrolls do not clearly and unambiguously make it clear how the teacher of righteousness met his death. Persecuted, yes, by the wicked priest, but not how he met his death. That is what we need. We need more material, quite a lot more. But whereas before the scrolls we as theosophists interested in these ideas are not at all surprised to find the scrolls being discovered. Not at all surprised, but everybody else is very surprised. Very surprised. When they were first discovered, people were saying, oh, the scrolls could be 100 AD or even forgeries, medieval. One or two scholars even said they're medieval at first. That was the very early days. Others said it could be 200 BC. And yet it was interesting to see that one felt one knew in advance what the verdict was going to be. Yes, it's going to be narrowed down, narrowed down, narrowed down, narrowed down. Till now, though we not all are agreed, there is a majority opinion that it is that the teacher was sometime in the first century BC. All are agreed that there are many contacts with the New Testament, though the extent of that contact is debated. So we have in no other sect in the early church that has come, of any record has come down to us, is there the same degree, the same number of contacts between the early church and the Dead Sea sect. There are more contacts than dissimilarities. There is one dissimilarity, though, one should recognize. In the Manual of Discipline, which gives the rules of the sect, it says, love your brother and hate your enemy. That's not Christian. But you see, the Manual of Discipline doesn't mention the teacher of righteousness. And it fits in very well if you make it an Essene document written before the coming of the teacher. After the teacher has come, in another document, the Zedekite document, it says, love your brother, but doesn't tell you to hate your enemy. There's been a change. And again, in the Manual of Discipline, written, as I suggest, before the teacher had appeared, there are only three groups of people. I'm not talking about the three groups of officials, but there were three groups of people. And in the Zedekite document, there are four, the fourth being proselytes, converts. Now, the Essenes, we know from Josephus, did not go in for missionary work. And it is sometimes said in our circles that Jesus was an Essene. I think we should be careful when we say that, to qualify it a little. According to Mrs. Besant, the ministry took place amongst the Essenes at first, but his brethren, the Essene brethren of Jesus, disagreed with him because he wished to preach to the multitudes. They said, no, you must keep these teachings within our circle. And so he parted from them. He was no longer, therefore, strictly speaking, an Essene when he went forth to preach to the multitudes. The Essenes would not speak to women. You know, there was a group of Essenes that had wives. And you will see the disciples are very surprised in the fourth gospel, and when the woman at the well, when Christ speaks to the woman at the well, and the disciples come up, and they're astonished to find him speaking to a woman. Why should they be astonished if he was just an ordinary Jew or a Pharisee? The Pharisees had no rules of that kind. It was the Essenes that had these restrictions. And we know, of course, from the Gospels, the very important part that women played in the ministry. So that was a break with Essene tradition. There was a break. And the teacher of righteousness did have proselytes, whereas before there was no room for them, before his coming. There was a change. And there were probably other changes as well, which would take too long to go into. But we do know from the Acts of the Apostles that in the very early days they held all things in common. That was what the Essenes did too. It didn't work for long, and the church started on its worldwide mission. Now, to close, I should like to put to you one or two points from a different point of view altogether. C.W. Leadbeater has explained that it is not etiquette to look up the lives of the great teachers unless they request it. And in fact, I understand that he didn't look up the lives of ordinary people, so to speak, without asking the ego's permission first. He was a gentleman first and foremost. But these statements about the life of the Lord, the life of Jesus, have been given, some information has been given out through theosophical sources. I suggest, therefore, that it could only have been given out at the request of the Lord himself. I venture to suggest that. With his approval. Can one venture to say why, or ask the question, why has he given this out? Well, I would like to suggest this. At the present time, a complete proof that the date was wrong, could we not say that that would be a very heavy blow for many people who are devoted followers of his in the Orthodox churches? Is it not possible that things are being so arranged that this idea is gradually permeating? The claims of the traditional churches, the traditional Protestant and Catholic churches, are completely identified with the Pilate date. If that claim was destroyed by really fully documented evidence, and C.W. Leadbeat, I understand, did say that evidence would come out, more evidence would eventually emerge. He said this before the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. They were discovered after his death. If that evidence were to come out all at once, we can imagine it would be a source of great distress to many genuine and sincere followers of Christ. But we may perhaps be ventured to think we are seeing it coming out gradually, bit by bit. And in the Lord's good time, if the full evidence is to come out, of course, it will come out. The claims of the historic churches as institutions will be very seriously affected by such a happening. See, the creed suffered under Pontius Pilate. The Gospels, it's quite clear in the Gospels that Christ died on the cross in the days of Pilate. It is only a mystical form of Christianity, a theosophical form of Christianity, if I may put it that way, but only the more mystical forms of Christianity which could survive such a happening. And it may be that it is part of the larger scheme of things. Who knows, it may have been foreseen by the Lord that the institution which he founded at great personal cost would someday, like all other human institutions, become too rigid and might even persecute men in his name. But it was better to found it with all its faults than not to come at all. And so he took on that burden. But in this new age, a new impulse might well be given, a new impulse may arise. And it is just possible, I would suggest to you, brethren, to close, that the sixth sub-race, we are told, is now coming into existence. Is beginning to emerge little by little. Its keynote is brotherly love and intuition. If the sixth subrace will have that keynote and will show that keynote, then perhaps we shall see an end of fossilized religions. It only becomes fossilized when people lack love, when they lack intuition. If we have love, if we have intuition, then perhaps we may see, during the coming centuries, new forms of religious expression which will not become fossilized, but will lead men into the heights.
That concludes this lecture by Mr. G. Nevin Drinkwater. This was recorded in Camberley in May of 1959.